welcome everybody to another episode of Going Nuclear here on the Clear Commodity Network. And this is Trevor Hall, your co-host, with my partner in crime and the most ever, probably the only person I've ever known that has a boxing bag in his rearview mirror at his office, Mr. Justin Hune, the Uranium Insider. Hey, Justin.
Good to see you, Trevor. We all have to find our own ways to deal with the volatility of markets, right?
What volatility? I mean,
I'm surprised you don't have two punching bags hanging behind you after the last few years in the mining sector.
I know. Well, in fact, it seems like we're on the right track here. I mean, we don't necessarily need to talk about precious metals. Obviously, those things have been rising. Base metals have been rising for the most part, but it's a full on, I guess, commodity inflationary story here across the board. I'm watching everything. From agriculture to the metals to energy, and even the spot price of uranium seems to be picking up a little bit, even following a nice little correction after those big highs to, I don't remember where we were, about $110 a pound, roughly here or there. But this has been a while since you and I have chatted here on the podcast of Going Nuclear, so maybe we just kind of pick it up where we left off, because it was a healthy little cooling off because things were pretty frothy back in the early part of the year.
Yeah, they were. We had such a good run from the late summer of last year into pretty much kind of early February. We had a decent pullback in December, and December was basically when both URA and URNM paid dividends, and there was kind of a lot of volatility around that, plus all the year-end stuff that typically happens in these types of markets, some profit-taking, some tax loss selling in the underperformers, et cetera, et cetera. But generally speaking, it's been a pretty solid run. So I'm just looking at the charts in the background from last summer until this recent peak in February. URA was up 50%. That's a big move for an ETF, right? Then the pullback was about a little less than 20%. So a decent little pullback, but historically speaking for this market, not a huge pullback. We've had, 30, 40, 50% pullbacks, the big one from the peak in November 2021 until kind of the summer of 2022, into the fall of 2022, that was a close to a 50% pullback. That was pretty gut-wrenching. This last one has been, actually, it's pulled back less than the actual price of the commodity. So the spot price for uranium ended the year at $90 a pound. Where is it right now? $89 a pound. It's actually down year to date, and it doesn't feel like it because there's been just an absolute flood of positive news around nuclear this year. And so the spot price pulling back even more than the equities are pretty solidly outperforming the metal since the year started. So I'm very happy to see that. It's been a while since we've really seen, let's say, high volume moves to the upside for the equities with the spot price not really doing anything meaningful. And that's a really good sign. That's the type of action that we saw, for example, at the beginning of the bull market, December 2020, when Larry McDonald's Bear Traps report, put out a note that they were going long uranium. And the spot price hadn't moved for a while and wasn't moving at the time. And then you saw that sort of trigger some momentum and volume came in. We saw huge moves in the sector with the spot price basically doing nothing. Kind of seeing that right now, although it's not really all that exuberant. But there's a lot of expectations kind of baked into this move, which is the market is expecting the price to keep moving higher. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's due to any specific near-term perceived catalyst or just the general overall positive sentiment around the sector, not really sure. But there's an underlying strength here to these things, so it's nice to see.
Yeah, you had mentioned a couple kind of quick tidbits in this latest newsletter of Uranium Insider. I think it's poignant to share. Mike Kozak of Cantor Fitzgerald said in an interview that he thinks this around these levels could be the floor moving forward for a spot price of uranium. But looking long term, about 5 to 7 years, because Adam Prom said in their March 15th earnings that they are kind of expecting a 21 million pound supply deficit by 2030. So that's 147 million pounds by 2040 shortfall as well. So, I mean, that's pretty meaningful. I mean, obviously it was exuberance here in 2023, but you got to think long-term here. I mean, the more volatile that sector is, the more volatile the correction could be. We want long, steady growth, don't we?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. What we don't want is a speculative driven spike that's driven by financial players primarily. And I don't think we're going to get that. I honestly think, and this is not my original thought here. This is coming from some other folks in the sector that have been in the nuclear industry, you know, close to as long as I've been on the planet, basically saying what we're seeing right now is much more similar to the 1970s than it is to the previous bull market for uranium, because that was such a flash in the pan, right? We had the commodity start to recover in the early 2000s, but we didn't really start to move until like 03, 04, and it peaked out in 07 with the GFC. After it kind of crashed during the GFC, it started to recover, and then we had Fukushima. So we were on our way to another sort of longer, steadier bull market after that speculative spike. But the drivers for this move are much more fundamentally driven and less speculatively driven. Yes, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust purchased 44 million pounds of uranium in the past 2 years. That's incredibly huge. And that certainly accelerated the thesis and soaked up a lot of above ground mobile inventory. But the drivers now of what we expect for this market going forward are not based around an expectation of capital flooding into the financial vehicles and them scooping up even more physical uranium in an extremely tight market. They are, nuclear is growing. We're in a nuclear renaissance. We're seeing life extensions in multiple countries. Just in the past week, we've seen three announcements of separate countries and separate jurisdictions engaging in life extensions. We're hearing talk about Diablo Canyon trying to extend 20 years. They only got a 5-year extension the past couple of years to go out to 2029, 2030. The Board of Supervisors in San Luis Obispo County, where it operates, approved the extension of this reactor. It obviously has to still go to the NRC, but we're seeing the Palisades reactor get restarted with funding from the feds. There's more life extension requests happening on the East Coast. New Jersey just announced, not New Jersey, the state, but the entity that operates these plants. I'm forgetting the name off the top of my head. Three plants in New Jersey, it's the second largest nuclear power station in the country, is going to request a 20-year life extension for all three plants. South Korea is going to life extend all 10 reactors that were supposed to shut down by 2030. That's 5.5 years, which means basically these reactors are expected to shut down. Now they're planning to life extend them. They're going to be in the market buying uranium. And then, of course, the Japanese restarts are accelerating a bit. I've been skeptical about this because it's been big talk for the past 2 years, but these restarts have not accelerated. They're very cautious. They're very careful. They want to make sure the surrounding communities are in support. They want to make sure that their anti-terrorism and earthquake, checks are in place. And all of that takes a lot of time. But we are expecting three restarts in Japan this year. Importantly, the first one is one unit at the Kashiwazaki Kariwa plant, which is the largest nuclear power station in the world. It's a 7-unit boiling water reactor, and that will be the first boiling water reactor to come online. Now, it's only one of those 7 units that's being restarted as of now, but the momentum is certainly moving that direction. So we have this this classic, relatively easy to model supply and demand story that every commodity investment should have, right? You want to see what's being consumed, what will be consumed, what's being produced, and what will be produced, and give you some idea of what to expect in the years going forward. So we have that, but we also have this absolute groundswell of momentum, positive support for nuclear, new builds, life extensions, restarts. It's almost universal across the board, with very few exceptions of countries embracing nuclear here.
Fortune magazine ran a story and is titled "U.S. Could Need the Equivalent of 40 New Nuclear Plants Over the Next 5 Years" by one estimate, and this made me chuckle. And power hogs, crypto, and cannabis are to blame. Oh, come on, crypto and cannabis, really? Let's just throw AI in there too.
yeah, it's funny because, you know, the power demand coming from AI data centers and data centers in general, and I would say electric vehicles, although that's slowing down a bit. Not in California, it's not slowing down, but generally speaking, the sales have been slowing a little bit. But the data center AI trend appears to be real. And this is something that is going to come to a head pretty quickly here because the electricity demand is massive. You know, to do a ChatGPT search, for example, rather than a classic Google search, the computing power and electricity demand of that single search consumes something like 10 to 20 times the amount of electricity.
Whoa.
And it's growing extremely fast, and big players are taking notice. We saw, of course, Amazon buy Talon Energy's data center because it was stationed, it is stationed right next to the Susquehanna nuclear power plant. This is a growing trend. Of course, new nuclear can't really respond like that. So a headline like the Fortune article is kind of is a little bit funny, right? But they're trying to put in perspective their expectation of electricity demand. And electricity demand in the United States has been flat for the last 15 years. And it's, you know, it only went up since the invention of electricity, and it flattened out over the last decade to two decades. Now it's growing again. It's the electrify everything. It's electric cars. It's AI. It's data centers. It's potentially cannabis growing, as that may or may not get more legal state approvals across this country and kind of in the world. A lot of indoor cannabis growing consumes a lot of electricity. Crypto mining, I don't have a handle on that, but I know it's not nothing. It's definitely a decent electricity demand, but the real growth driver is coming from this AI data center demand. And it's going to be a problem. We're going to see constrained grids in this country, probably in the next 2 years, from all of these factors, but especially from that. And there's going to have to be an enormous amount of money being thrown at it to fix the problem. It's going to have to happen relatively quickly.
You know, a poignant, timely story here. Literally this morning, I was at the gym and ran into a buddy who helps build data centers, and he's been building a number of them for the last couple of years here. And he's told me, interestingly, they just got done building one that's a redundant data center. So it's a backup to the original data center. Just in case the original goes down, they have a backup. And it's not just like, you know, a computer. It's like an entire facility, sometimes four stories high. It's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And this trend is so powerful. I've been seeing it kind of in the background. My wife is a photographer, and she does some pretty brilliant digital editing to her photography. And she's been fascinated by the AI trend. She's really into it. So she's been studying it and taking courses on it and creating images and video. And she was just showing me last night how she was taking one of my recorded videos and plugging it into this AI model, and it popped it out with me speaking perfect Spanish. And I speak decent Spanish as it is, but it
wow.
just uploading the video, and it looked pretty darn good. It's a little bit scary from a non-investment perspective, just looking at the potential. Like when I see something now, Trevor, on social media, I literally almost don't react to it because I don't know if what I'm seeing is real.
Right.
And if I can't be the only one like that. And this is going to be a problem going forward. This is neither here nor there, but the trend is absolutely real. And I'm even finding myself very rarely now, am I even going to Google and searching? I open ChatGPT if I want to search up some information. Mm-hmm. It's so much better. It's so much more accurate, so much faster to get into the results of what I'm trying to find in an online query. And it's moving fast. It's moving very fast. And that demand is real.
You're not the only one, Justin. I feel the same way. I wonder when the regulations come down. By the time the regulations on artificial intelligence start popping up, it's probably going to be too late, because that's usually the way those things work. But we are maybe digressing from the conversation. So let's jump into our conversation with our guest this week, Justin, because it's a little bit of a spin. I mean, we're happy to welcome in Jennifer Avellaneda Diaz from Westinghouse. She's a nuclear energy advocate. Not obviously female, but oh man, she's young, she's energetic, she has a lot of good ideas. She's maybe one of the most prolific advocates for nuclear energy out there, you know, online and in person, I think I've seen in a long time. So it's great to see.
Yeah, I'm very excited to speak with Jennifer. I've been following her on Twitter/X for quite a few years. She's known as Nuclear Hazelnut on that platform. And I was I was lucky enough to be on in a Twitter Spaces with her, but there were some technical difficulties with that. So I didn't really get to engage in much of a conversation with her at the time. So looking forward to speaking with her both about developments at Westinghouse. Seems like we're seeing headlines about Westinghouse pretty frequently with new nuclear builds happening, especially in places like Poland and kind of the nuclear fuels market, Eastern Europe, that historically has been dominated by Russia, that now Westinghouse is producing fuel rods for those Russian designed reactors and taking up a lot of that market, which is pretty exciting for the company. But also just to hear from a young impassioned person in the nuclear energy world and hear about kind of what she's seeing across the world in terms of this quote unquote nuclear renaissance that we're always discussing from somebody that's in it. I'd like to hear her unique perspective. So looking forward to this chat for sure.
Yeah. It'd be nice and healthy, so people don't have to listen to old farts like you and I keep pounding the table, Justin. All right, well, let's jump into this conversation with Jennifer right now. Well, Jennifer, it's a pleasure to have you on to the Going Nuclear podcast. In fact, we should have had you on a long time ago, but I'm glad we could make this happen today.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invite, Trevor. I'm very happy to be here with you too. Hi, Jesse. Yeah.
Hello, Jennifer. Good to see you.
Yeah. You're prolific online. You post a lot of content about what you're doing with Westinghouse and as a nuclear energy advocate. I don't think you spend more than one day in the same place anymore because your work and conversations continue to keep moving you across the country, if not across the globe. But I think for people that gets a little bit more familiar with you, Jennifer, let's talk about your background. You don't have a very extensive career. You're quite young, but how did this all kind of come about?
Yeah, thank you so much, Trevor. I think that's a very interesting question, by the way. So long story short, I have a Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Development Engineering. So I am not like officially a nuclear engineer yet. I'm on my way, probably my master's. But I am an engineer. I've studied 5 years the generation of clean energy. And I basically fell in love with the nuclear energy industry because at the same time, I grew up learning a little bit more about this problem that we all shared, which is climate change. And when I started, doing my research, studying each one of the energy generations and the difference between them, I learned about nuclear. And I mean, nuclear is basically the answer. But right now we have a problem. It is very politicized, unfortunately. So that's why I am advocating for nuclear 24/7. And as you said, I am an engineer, probabilistic risk assessment engineer working at Westinghouse Electric Company. And I basically use this methodology in order to answer a basic question, which is what could go wrong? What is the possibility of that event escalating? And how can I mitigate it? So that's what I do with nuclear power stations. And I also volunteer my time to advocate for nuclear energy, as you said, in social media. And I am also more than happy to donate my time, to going to conferences, being a speaker, join certain panel discussions. I'm just very happy to give the nuclear energy industry a place whenever there's a clean energy conversation.
Yeah, doing God's work for sure. It's really interesting. I've been following nuclear energy from the investment side, starting all the way back in 2016, and I also fell in love with the story as well. And part of the reason was that at the time that I discovered, the investing thesis was really the price of uranium had bombed out and was trading so low that producers couldn't make money, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. But what I quickly realized was that I knew nothing about nuclear energy. And what I did think that I knew was entirely wrong. And I remember very quickly going back, because at the time it was only 5 years since the Fukushima Daiichi accident. And I remember going back at the time, feeling really frightened, feeling very concerned that, okay, this just happened at this nuclear plant that I know nothing about. And it's very scary. And there's 400 more of these things in the world. Oh my God, I had no clue. Of course, digging into the sector from the investment side of things over the years, I've discovered that it's ultra safe, historically speaking, statistically. Yet still, in a lot of, I'm sure that you find in just kind of dinner conversations and things like that, it's still a very misunderstood technology. So can you give us a little bit more? One of your most popular tweets that I've saw was you discussing nuclear waste and how safe nuclear waste is, and that there's never been an accident with nuclear waste. But just generally, what are some common misconceptions around nuclear that you find yourself disproving commonly in average, you know, kind of day-to-day conversations with people about this technology?
Yeah, definitely. So actually, that's what I started to use X, previously Twitter, because I think I am able to reach out to more people rather than, for example, using TikTok or any other social media platform. And what I do there is basically to answer the quote-unquote dumb questions that I used to have when I was learning about this industry. What about the waste? What would happen if I fell into a spent fuel pool? What would happen if a plane crashes the containment building? What would happen when I turn or shut down my reactor, right? Those type of questions that right now I do have an answer for those because I do that on a daily basis. And going back to your questions, I do believe that the perspective, the wrong perspective that people usually have regarding the industry has to do with safety and security, 100%. Like, oh my God, but it could explode like a nuclear weapon. Oh, let me explain to you the huge difference between those two things, right? So that's basically it. The narrative behind the safety and security surrounding the nuclear energy industry.
Jennifer, I mean, maybe talk about the evolution of the sentiment that you've of nuclear energy that you've been, deeply involved with over the last, number of years. But, we've gone from, post Fukushima, no way, close reactors, close everything you can, don't mine uranium, that type of very negative sentiment to, oh my gosh, this is actually something that we're seeing the light now. There's a lot more support. We're actually seeing, Justin and I in our introduction just talked a lot about a lot of reactors that were supposed to be closed down are actually being refurbished and putting extended life on it. And so this is a huge shift. I mean, it's like turning this massive ship around very quickly here in the last year or two. But talk about the roller coasters, about what you're seeing in that sentiment shift. Was there a moment in time where those conversations got easier for you?
Well, as I always said, people's concerns are valid. Their questions are totally valid because they don't know what people working within the industry know. You know, they don't have that education. They don't have all of the concepts and information that we use on a daily basis. So part of the misinformation and the wrong perspective of the industry has to do with that, with the access of information and also with all of the fake news that are surrounding it. Part of why I started doing this advocacy journey was because I do remember when the armed conflict started between Ukraine and Russia, and CNN posted something like, Chernobyl is about to happen again. Like, beware. What would happen in Europe? This is the biggest plant in Europe. This is going to be like plus 10 times dangerous, right? And I was like, no, that is not what's going to happen. For the starters, Chernobyl won't happen again. You know, like, we have learned from that. We have many years of operating experience. But people doesn't know that because you see CNN and it's like, oh, they must know things. Like, they must be telling us the truth. So it's like, you know what? I'm someone working at the industry and it's among all of us to share what we know so people can have an informed opinion of what happened. And I think this momentum, the increase on the support of nuclear power started very recently when, after Fukushima happened, people was very concerned and there were a lot of fake news surrounding it. I even remember there was a map that was explaining the height of the waves that were coming from Japan towards the coast of California and all that section of the American continent, right? But people started to share that specific graph saying, these are the level of radiation that are coming from Japan. And it's like, no, these are basically heights of the waves that are coming from there. It has nothing to do with radiation. So the misinformation kept, like, you know, increasing because of that specific event. So recently, I had the opportunity to go to COP28, which is a United Nations climate change conference. And when I saw that 20 countries, afterwards, there were a couple more that joined this pledge, but 20 countries pledged to triple nuclear energy by 2050. That's our momentum, the momentum of nuclear energy advocates and the momentum of the people working within the industry to keep pushing this correct idea of the many benefits that not only nuclear energy, but also nuclear applications have. And we also need, as nuclear advocates, to start normalizing the correct vocabulary behind it. Because most of the people, as you said, for example, nuclear medicine, you're like, oh, that will cause me cancer. But not at all. It's totally opposite. Actually, nuclear medicine could help you to treat and potentially cure cancer, you know? So we just gotta keep pushing, keep informing people, providing them with the correct sources so they can have an informed opinion. Like, hey, you have the resources. You make up your mind. I'm no imposition here to try to convince you. This is not like a political party, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You just have the resources, read it by yourself. If you have any questions, I'm free to answer them.
Are there any of those countries that are maybe leading the way the most, or any ones that stand out the most?
I would say, as I previously mentioned, there were 20 initially that came together and pledged this. But I would say the countries that could certainly give an example are the leaders within this technology. US, France, you know, these two that are basically pushing it and supporting it since the 1950s and are actually seeing and living the many benefits that these source of energy is bringing.
Any countries that surprised you that you didn't see come to the table?
There's a nuclear energy advocate, Will Shackle, that is currently pushing this agenda in Australia. So there's still a huge misunderstanding and underestimation of this technology in Australia. And he's a wonderful nuclear energy advocate that is actually in charge of educating the people and educating the lawmakers over there, because they not only do not have nuclear energy, but they also have one of the greatest resources that we need, which is uranium, right? So we gotta keep bringing countries to this side of the table. Like, hey, we all have this problem in common, climate change. And we also need energy security. Better together. If you want a cleaner future, not only a cleaner present, but also a cleaner future, let's bring nuclear to the table. I'm not saying no to solar or no to wind, because I know many other countries is like, yeah, clean, it's equal to only solar and wind. No, no, no. Let's also bring all of the others. The better together, the better.
Jennifer, one country that I was a little bit surprised by, pleasantly surprised by, is Poland, which they have gone from having arguably the dirtiest grid in all of Europe, and now seemingly moving very quickly towards building nuclear. They've made multiple deals with multiple different companies. I believe the Westinghouse is one of them. So I'm very curious, just kind of on the Westinghouse side of things, like, how busy has Westinghouse been and you have been with the company? How is that increased over the last, let's say, 2 to 3 years? And how significant is the interest in new builds currently for Westinghouse and otherwise, just in some of what your observations kind of globally?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I previously shared with you guys, it's that I currently support some national and international nuclear power plants regarding the PRA risk analysis, right? So on this side, in order for me to do my job, I need some operating experience, or I need for a nuclear power station to be already like there and working, right? Or going through an outage, or you know, mitigating performance indicators, something like that. I need a plan to be already there. So as far as this upcoming opportunity that Westinghouse had with Poland, I haven't been like actively participating on that. But something I do know is that the more countries that are opening for this idea and trying to, you know, are open to the market on receiving biddings and all that stuff, Westinghouse do has a lot of job because, you know, we have not only the technology that we have been working on, the PWRs, but we now have the AP1000, the AP300, and also the Vinci. So there's a lot of work surrounding these specific projects, and I am very, very excited for the upcoming ones that will certainly start growing within internationally. You know, the more countries, the merrier, especially Poland, as you mentioned. Again, this industry is highly politicized. And I do remember Poland is like, oh, no, I'm not following instructions from Germany. And Germany on the other side is like, yeah, you said that correctly. So, you know, it's also something good to have social media tools right now, because it's not like we can only trust certain sources, but we can also look for information, look for some other voices that were present at certain events. Like, hey, can you tell me what that really that happened? Were you there? Who was there? You know, in real time, you can actually have information in real time. So that's also in our favor.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking,
go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on the when you mentioning the AP300 and the eVinci reactors. So these are both quote unquote small modular reactors, I suppose. This seems like a incredibly huge trend with massive potential, not just for Westinghouse with these two designs, but with SMRs in general. What are you seeing in terms of countries that are interested in building new nuclear, whether that's Westinghouse or otherwise? Are they leaning more towards building small reactors or large reactors?
So far, I've seen the latter. They are very focused on the small modular reactors. And personally, I do believe those are good news. I mean, it's new technology. It's more flexible. It's modular. You know, you need less territory-less area in order to put one of those. Although I'm a lover of current nuclear power plants. I love them. I know there are many huge possibilities, all the jobs that they create and all the many benefits that they bring to the area where they are located at, you know? So I'm still going to fight for the idea of for them or for new clients to consider both. You know, could be an AP1000 or it could be an SMR. It doesn't matter. As long as they want nuclear, as long as they welcome nuclear to their market.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, we had somebody from Rolls-Royce on a couple months ago, and it was a great conversation. So maybe I asked him a similar question in that conversation regarding the competitiveness of the small module reactors right now. It is a relatively new technology. Adoption is obviously gaining some traction, but you know, I wouldn't say we're in a boom cycle of that infrastructure build out quite yet. And so, you know, Westinghouse is obviously a very well known name as far as engineering and infrastructure for a very long time. So maybe talk about, you know, the competitiveness of the small module reactor market right now, given, you know, it's a few players that are in there. There's startups in there as well, but also, you know, just it's like we're on the cusp of this being adopted a lot, but we're just not quite there yet. We're not over that hurdle.
Yeah, no, regarding that statement, you're totally on the correct side. And that's basically the way I think. I mean, our current nuclear power stations, the ones that are currently operating, they can be extended for many, many years. I mean, as long as we keep maintaining them the way we do, testing them the way we do, and PRA's engineers doing their job, they could operate forever, if you ask me. And again, I do support these new technologies, and I know that they're going to bring many benefits that the current one, for example, cannot give you. One of them, modularity. Transportability, you know, like these type of things, flexibility that you can mix very well. That doesn't mean that the SMRs are gonna be the new stuff and people are going to forget about the current nuclear power plants, because we still need those, I mean, energy-wise. So I do think that we gotta find a balance. And also that depends on the budget that certain countries have. Probably they cannot even have the area to welcome an AP1000, but they can certainly welcome, I don't know, 5 SMRs if needed. Mm-hmm. So that would certainly depend, but I will always fight for the inclusion of SMRs plus the unlimited maintenance and availability of nuclear power operating stations.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, where do you see new nuclear happening? Or let me rephrase that. Do you see new nuclear happening in the United States?
Yes, and I'm pushing for that. That's part of the reason why I came to DC. Because I tried to contact a couple of lawmakers, especially the ones from Texas, because I also want to see nuclear to grow in Texas, because, you know, I am there. But I made something clear during the Nuclear Communication Forum that took place at the Nuclear Energy Institute. I made sure to take advantage of the many representatives of different American utilities that were there. And I was like, I told them, we gotta keep building and we gotta keep pushing that. I understand that it takes time and we gotta find the budget and, you know, the support from the lawmakers. I totally understand, but let's keep pushing. Let's not just sit down and wait until that happens. Use us, the nuclear energy advocates, to make some noise, to keep pushing our lawmakers, to contact them. I recently, now that you bring this topic to the table, I recently contacted Senator John Cornyn. Hopefully I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. He's from Texas. And I also contacted our other senator, Ted Cruz, twice, both. I didn't receive any reply back from Mr. Cruz. I did receive one from Mr. John Cornyn, but he totally lost the topic. I actually said on my email, like, hey, thank you so much for the hard work that you're doing. My name is Jennifer. I'm a nuclear energy advocate. I'm an engineer, and I'm really eager to keep bringing, you know, to keep growing this industry within the Texas. We would certainly benefit from that, not only myself, but many people regarding energy security, employment, and clean energy. And he was like, his answer was literally a copy-paste, which I am very much, because I saw it and I read it from his webpage. And it was like, yeah, that's why I supported the idea of hydrogen, or something like that, something totally non-related. And then he had like, yeah, and I know that Texas provides XYZ percentage of solar and XYZ percentage of oil and gas. And it's like, that's not even my topic. I was literally telling you I'm donating my time for whatever your idea is to keep growing this industry in Texas. So yeah, I'll just keep pushing. And I invite anyone that's listening to this podcast to contact your lawmakers. You know, yeah. They are working for the good of your society, and you are part of the citizens. So it's also new.
Well, they can just forward this podcast to all the lawmakers, the senators and congressmen and women. Hey, Jennifer, I mean, we talked a lot about nuclear energy infrastructure, but this requires fuel. And I know a lot of your work is done on, you know, the SMRs and the building infrastructure of it all. And I would like to turn the topic here, what you're seeing as far as the complexities of uranium mining and supply and fuel supply. Obviously, you can't have that small module reactor without the fuel. And so there's another topic that obviously, you know, is a double-edged sword for many people. What are you seeing in regards to mining, uranium supply? Is it something people are coming to terms with, that you will have to mine uranium and put it through the processing to create the nuclear fuel? Is that something people are also coming to terms with regarding in the sentiment improving?
Yeah, well, there are certainly two topics that I would like to touch regarding this very interesting question. Everything needs mining. Everything, even solar panels and wind, you know, like everything needs mining. That's the way we worked as humans in this planet Earth. One of our main suppliers, and when I say our, I mean America in general, is Canada. And we are very close to Canada. They keep providing us with this fuel, with all the factories that they have, and you know, the people that work on that. Part of that is why I also believe the work of Will Shackle keeps, it's still very important because of Australia. We just got to keep working continuously with all the countries and keep providing mutually resources that the other one doesn't have, right? Because we're going to need it. If we triple nuclear energy, we certainly need to triple the demand for uranium, right?
Mm-hmm.
On a second matter, I would also love to keep pushing the idea, at least in the United States, to start reusing spent fuel. Because that's something that already has like a certain technicality, and it's a process that is already being used by other countries. As we were mentioning before, another of our nuclear leaders, which is France, they already do that. So why not starting doing this today in America? I'm certainly sure that we do have the budget. But you know, I actually asked somebody, and I forgot the name of this person, but this person works at the DOE, at the Department Office of Energy. And when we asked what would happen if we start, you know, like working on this idea and start reprocessing the fuel that we already have on spent fuel casks, and she was like, oh, we are really afraid of nuclear weapons proliferation. And it's like, there's no history that has already happened, because I know personally the level of security that you have to access and enter the area of a nuclear power plant. So the idea of someone else just entering and accessing a nuclear power plant area just to steal a huge 2 meters cask of spent fuel, I mean, it's crazy. So I do think they just keep pushing this idea just to say, no, we don't want to, you know, invest in that, in reprocessing the used fuel. But that's also something that I want to keep pushing, this idea towards lawmakers. You know, like, this is something that we can actually accomplish. I know, for example, that at the very beginning, it could be a little bit more expensive to reprocess rather than get more. But again, it's all a matter of having a balance. You can always rely on that you're going to be getting new uranium from certain countries. You cannot just rely on that. And we also have a spent fuel there, usually called waste. It is not waste. These are just resources that are not being used and are waiting for us to reuse them.
Mm-hmm. It also is would potentially be a great talking point, because that's besides the... What about Chernobyl? The other big question is, what about the waste, right? From people that know nothing about nuclear. Okay, well, the waste does exist. Historically, it's extremely safe. There's a tiny amount of waste produced. And also, it's largely being reprocessed. But we can't really say that besides the French, right? And I think that the Japanese are building out their own MOX facility as well, if I recall correctly. So it might, maybe it's just a matter of cost. This is something I've asked folks in the sector multiple times over the years, is why are only the French doing this? Why is nobody else doing this? And so there might be some, like you said, some considerations around proliferation, and because you have to extract plutonium, right, from the waste material. But it also might just be a cost thing. And if we see the price of uranium continue to rise, which I believe that we will, we already have the cost of conversion and enrichment are quite high. So all things being equal, we might get to a cost environment where it will make financial sense to start looking into reprocessing. So, and again, that would also be a really good talking point for the industry. So fingers crossed on that as well. But yeah, it's good to see, just generally speaking, the momentum around nuclear. Besides the investing side of things for myself, I'm also an advocate, since I've learned as much as I have about the industry. It's it's a no-brainer that we need to expand nuclear energy. And I'm really pleased to see that. And especially here in the United States, because we have the biggest fleet in the world, as of now, I think that China will surpass us within about 5 years as fast as they're building.
They're really building.
Yes. Yeah. So, but it is good to see the Department of Energy with the Biden admin be so supportive of nuclear. It seems like the NRC is kind of being pulled in the same direction, maybe, hopefully, knocking on wood. But I would love to see some new nuclear be built here. And it's great to see the demonstration projects for TerraPower and X-Energy. And it would be awesome to see just the skilled force at Westinghouse build another AP1000 since we just did it. Let's do it again. Now that there's so much that can be learned from that project, from the Vogtle project. And even the DOE's liftoff report covering nuclear, they did their own kind of small analysis of, okay, what kind of went wrong with the Vogtle project? How can we fix that? Have the engineering finished before starting, you know, those kind of things. So knocking on wood, I'd love to see that continue to move. Canada looks like they're moving in the right direction. Do you have any experience with heavy water and CANDU reactors and why we're not seeing more of those being built besides in India?
No, not personally. I'm sorry, I cannot help you on that topic.
That's okay.
I do remember, though, that I gave a very insightful presentation to my team on Westinghouse regarding the technology of CANDUs. But I haven't personally worked on those yet. You never know.
I know our mutual friend, Mark Nelson, is very, very, he's very much an advocate for CANDU, as well as some other folks in the industry, for sure.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I mean, I am pro all technologies. I know that I work for Westinghouse Electric Company, but I am also a nuclear energy advocate. So I don't care what technology you use. As long as it works, it benefits us all, bring it. I mean, the more the merrier.
Jennifer, you know, kind of off the cuff question here regarding labor force. I mean, you're about to be nuclear energy engineer, as you stated. If we are to build out and increase the fleet of nuclear reactors, it's going to require a number of more nuclear engineers, right? And people that understand the process. Where are we at with the workforce now with nuclear engineering? You know, do we have enough? Is there a push to bring new students into nuclear fuel cycles and engineering?
Well, I want to put myself in the spot, actually, as I previously mentioned earlier during this conversation, I am not a nuclear engineer. Although I am an engineer, I still had the opportunity to become part of this incredible industry. And that's why I also love to share during this podcast is that if you're listening to this, you don't need to become a nuclear engineer or you don't need to be a nuclear engineer to come and work within the industry. There are so many opportunities. A single nuclear reactor, because there are plants that have more than one reactor, a single nuclear reactor can employ up to 1,200 people. So can you imagine if we triple by 2050 our nuclear fleet? Imagine how many jobs are going to be created just by one single nuclear power station. Now imagine to triple those. So you don't need to be a nuclear engineer per se to come and work in the industry. You don't even need to be an engineer. You can also be a communicator, as a wonderful people that I just met during this past forum at the NEI. You could also be a journalist, a publicist, a business person, you know? Everyone is welcome to the industry. We not only need engineers.
Or newsletter writers and podcast hosts. That's amazing. So tell me, how does the rest of your summer shaping up? I mean, there's a lot of news out there. The market itself in uranium, Justin and I were just talking, is taking a breather. I mean, the last part of 2023, it was just kind of nuts, you know, from the investment and market standpoint. But what are you seeing here, you know, within, as we walk into the spring and the summer, with some of the big conversations that are on your plate?
You mean regarding the uranium market?
Yeah.
Well, nuclear power plants work 24/7, 90% of the year, except when we are during an outage. We need the fuel. I mean, if we want to keep providing safe, reliable, and clean energy to all the residences and businesses surrounding the area of a nuclear power plant, we need the fuel. And we do that usually on average every 18 months. So we shut down the plant. We also create a couple of temporal employments so we can bring more people to help us during an outage. And we do a lot of maintenance, a lot of testing while the fuel is being changed. And that usually lasts between a month and a half. So that's why I say 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we are always going to be requiring fuel. Otherwise, the plan won't work. So the market will always be open. We have 93 nuclear power plants just in America. The demand is there. Hopefully, the supply too.
All right. Jennifer. Thanks so much for your time. I know you are so busy, so I really appreciate you giving some of your precious time to us and doing this interview. It's a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Justin and Trevor. I had such a great time, and hopefully more people will become an advocate for nuclear energy after listening to this wonderful podcast.
Yeah. Well, and remind people where they can find you.
Oh, yes. So I am Nuclear Hazelnut on X, formerly Twitter, and you can also find me on Instagram.
All right. At Nuclear Hazelnut on Instagram as well?
Yes.
All right. Very good. All right. Jennifer, thank you so much. Justin, good to see you. Until next time, have a great rest of your day, everybody.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Going Nuclear, Justin, or myself, and the Clear Commodity Network team and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.